So the way we're going to do this is I'll read a few poems, then Ruth and I will have a conversation, then Ruth will get up and read. That's it, isn't it? We're not changing from that.
No, we're going to stick to that.
We're going to try and work with our theme.
Yeah. But we do talk to each other.
We will, yeah, like now. Should we do it? Yeah. We did talk in the back about, you know, how to sculpture this kind of session, what poems to read. We've had a little chat. I thought I'd start one about going to India. So I was really thinking about the first and second generation. And there's a tradition that's built up in Britain prior to a wedding, an Indian wedding. The family often will go back to India to buy loads of items for the dowry. Because for the dowry, you have to buy for most of your relatives on your side of the family and for the other side of the family. So it requires a lot of things. And for my parents, they go to a place in near the Golden Temple, Jalandhar. And that, you know, and I want, in this poem, I just want to capture that snootiness, the snootiness of the mother with the daughter going back because they're in the West and they feel superior to the locals. And I've just got a quote from Tamerlane Marlowe's, and he says, "I mean to cut a channel that men might quickly sail to India." So it's sort of fancy that the mother and the daughter going to India to buy up stuff and then come back. So it's called For the Wealth of India. "To Arafat, the savage miles, in a moment, tucking under continents to clip the distance, zoomed to our ancestral homeland, so we ransack the bazaar tracks of back-alley bounteous Jalandhar, ranting down the marker prices to a smudge paid by my permed auntie in Warsaw, bombing through the brightly lit boutiques, mum beating a brow, stomping a finger, so a gold-toothed owner clicks to a knobbly knees, bent-necked man who trays us with milky sweets and cans of Fanta, who says, 'God you bless, mem sahibs,' twisting away with a snarl, I see it, punting my heel up his arse, I scurry him off like a rat. From the stalls of the shop, posted with Madhu Dixit and Wham, we shoot through the glossy pages of the tea-stained catalogues for the blood sari to wow the guests into awe when I walk the aisle to the holy book of my biggest day. 'That's the style, mummy. I need it now, mummy. The ultimate design to highlight my super long legs.' But the tailors scratch their necks, snort, reversing some phlegm until mum clears them with her finest English. 'What is this corruption? We need it fut-a-fut, or must we go to the clean-nosed Hindu with cut-cut scissors next door?' Daddy would applaud if he wasn't slogging at the concrete factory. The pongy tailors now run like flies now that time is against them, as we debate with the queue of Englanders the top carrot beauty of exotic things and which riffraff road in Southall we all left for Harrow. The locals steal looks from us for ages until mum blinks them with the sun off her gemmed Rolex. I wonder if mum's old family were trapped over here, too sweaty for style with all the pigs sniffing sewers, so heavy and holding. Oh well, what a shame. As we lap up our suits, shoes and bags of bangles and cheapo knickers, tossing them at the slouch driver of the flimsy rickshaw to shout, 'Jaldi, jaldi, back to Britain, get us out of here,' spinning a penny to some limbless in a bucket. This is what we do." Yeah, it's that kind of global world, isn't it? The way it kind of becomes crazy and shrunk and it's weird and wonderful. Okay, I'll read a poem from my second collection, the Tipu one. I did some research about the empire, the British Empire, because I was really fascinated with it. I see it as my kind of, you know, heritage. Because if it wasn't for the empire, my parents wouldn't have come over here. So my dad came over because the British went to Punjab, you know, to advertise for workers. And when I was out there in Calcutta doing some research, because that's obviously the seat of power for a while, I came across a book by Elizabeth Mazzucchelli, a Victorian travel writer. And I just sort of took a reimagined one of the sections. She talks about going, you know, from Darjeeling, from Calcutta up to Darjeeling, which in Victorian times could take about 3 months. It's a kind of hell of a journey. And I just got this one little staging post, just going from one bit to another, with this really sinister, mischievous Indian driver, the one who's taking him through this bit of landscape. And anyway, it's a chance to do a bit of kind of spooky writing. And I was just fascinated, like, what are they doing? It's amazing, aren't they? Some of these English back in Victorian time, going to these really remote outposts. It's quite phenomenal, risking their lives. And in this book, she does talk about her husband, the chaplain, and she often... He just seems this really feeble, pathetic man. So I wanted to pick up on that in this poem. So it's called The Ascent of a Victorian Woman. To see Darjeeling and die, to witness the mountains pronged to the heavens and reside in a temperate clime. Though the trek to our cross on the mount is a damper, the chaplain opines, the journey's the thing. While the train may have crossed the Alpine peaks, at our staging post, once past the cupolas and domes of Calcutta, past the deadly swamps, the morass and fens of the Hooghly, a region as though of Atlantis, with merely the tips of palm trees peeking through, we are met by our somewhat pallid driver. With the most compounded respect, madams, meet the GBT. The what, I ask? Madam, this carriage, comparable to a summer's day, is the government bullock train. Said with exuberant pride that even the D of his there seems capitalised. How the Hindu, who was once the cradle of civilization, has fallen into parody. For our driver directs us to a hackery furnished with a rough tilt and yoked by two scrawny bullocks. Then toosling his whiskers, he points at the chaplain. Madam, is that most excelling person with you also, lady? I'm forced to exclaim, that is my husband. By and by, the chaplain unravels from blankets to reveal his unmistakably mannish boot. His why, you brute, meets a flurry of, sorry, sahib. Our driver makes no apology for not greasing the wheels of squeaking solid wood. He sits proudly astride a pole and flogs the bullocks. My pleas for mercy lead him to twirl their tails with lashings of betitudes and banjudes, apparently from a lexicon of expletives. He provokes no response from the natives lying shriveled on their charpoys beneath what passed for trees. What passed for bees seem asleep on the wild flowers with no hurry for honey. The rooks too seem possessed by the climate and do not whirl about the elms. A butterfly seems to pass the day folded on a harebell stalk, and a screech from a bird passes by unrequited over the sinister two-bodied gore. The chaplain groans with a migraine, as if his heart from the journey's bosom had absented from the outset. When asked of our whereabouts, our driver, who's perpetually lunged into a style of a jockey, asserts, Sahib, our petty base is far from the Grand Trunk Road. Any more I can no prognosticate. The delivery of our Shakespeare Walla remains unnerving. He has the patter of a barbu who works for a public works department. In any case, he leads us where humanity has entirely receded, along the narrowest breadth of harsh white phantom ground, for the fulsome flatland days and dusty miles. For we seem no closer to our real ascent, and with the thermometer standing at anything you care to mention. Okay, how are we doing? Okay, so I'll read a section from my version of the Ramayana. Some of you may be aware of the Ramayana. Nobody really knows when it was first written. It's an oral story. It's probably over 2,000 years old. And it, you know, exists as a Hindu story, as a Buddhist story, as a Jain. And Sikh, the 10th Guru, did a version of the Ramayana as well, because the Sikhs were being oppressed by the Muslims, and he wanted to use the Ramayana as a clarion call. And also the story varies from region to region, so there's no one actual authoritative text, which is very exciting for me, because I'm very into trying to create kind of global text more and more in my writing. So that really drew me to it, the fact that, you know, exists in many, within India, exists in many stories and forms, and then it's a story in Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, Burma, and up in Tibet, and they all have their different versions of the Ramayana, and in some of the countries they have different character names, but the story is fairly similar. And, you know, it's that classic epic story where girl meets boy, she gets abducted, and then the husband has to go into battle to win her back. Yeah. Then it's got a few twists and turns after. And then it was originally sort of five books, and then it becomes more of a saga, I think. It becomes seven books. It just goes on and gets added on. And I just want to keep to the epic style of it and took bits, I guess, from various different versions to make it as varied as possible and try to take language, you know, whether it be Australian, American English, British English, whatever, and also think of, you know, it exists as a puppet show, it exists as, you know, theatre in all different forms. So I want to really capture a spirit of something that's not really settled in any way, that seems to kind of hover and shift in its construction even. I'll read this section. So this is what, we're going to meet Rama for the first time. So we've had various other things going on. So Rama's in the desert with his sage and his brother, and they've been trained up to slay demons. Okay? So they're going to meet this demon in the desert, and Rama has to take her on to prove he's kind of, you know, he's up for a bigger battle that's ahead. So Rama, as far as he knows, is human, and this is one of the interesting things in the story. In most of the versions, he's human, but he seems to have his incredible powers. And later on, he comes to understand he's got his powers, and he can't really reconcile being mortal and powerful at the same time. Anyway, this section is called Kill That Mother. Perfect drought everywhere, horizoned in a desert. Heat licking heat in a death lust, where only is growing death. Deep in the desert and somehow unfazed, as if this were not miracle enough, a mere boy wearing a divine blue demeanour was steadfast walking, nippy walker, whose feet were barely touching the ground, for the speed of his crossing too was unnaturally composed. So, who was this warrior-looking walker? Rama, of course, Rama, the mighty boy already with lithe but supernaturally powered limbs. Rama was being followed by his brother Lakshmana, and a bit behind was sage Viswamitra. They were north of Ayodhya, in the sun's anvil, a sun that slumped its deadening weight on stone and rock, turning rock and stone into fine-spun sand. The sage explained this was the sole way to the sacrificial ground, adding, here was once a jolly people zone, with gardens and grounds like bazaars, bright with fruits. But a demon family, a family of Rakshasi, lived here once, who turned the region into a desert. Only their mother, Tadaka, remains. Rama and Lakshmana looked about nervously as the sage sniffed the air. Tadaka pierces anything alive with her spiky trident. Not even here will you hear the shrill beetle, all being spiked. Tadaka roams here still. My vow of non-violence means you must step up. The sage stood Lakshmana back with him, for it was clear Rama was being tested. Rama pleaded, where is she? Before the sage answered the question was being answered by a rackety storm ploughing towards the sage and the boys. What formed through the ploughing before Rama was a normal-sized woman, but with eyes gobbing fire, with fangs dribbling molten. All of it hung on an old mama, bereft of her boys and her husband. Good grief. Rama knew mum was not the warrior word, and hardened as recipient of this fiend's three-pronged spear, which came at shrill speed for his brows and arrived within eyeshot, just in time for Rama's nimble-fingered stringing of his massive bow, so his arrow flew just in time to shatter her spear. The shattered spiky shards flew up and, gaining speed, rained sharply down into the mum, stabbing her in her tender flesh parts. Tadaka was dead. Spectating overhead, the gaggle of ebullient gods made life move fast forward across a once desolate region. They made flowers plurp into dandy lives of purples and tangs, shaded by newly sprung panasa, palm and mango trees. The gods chimed into the sage's inner voice. Grant to this fine-handed boy the deepest know-how. He may be the saviour. Over the coming seasons, upon his willing wunderkind, the sage delivered the subtlest A to Z techniques, So both Rama and Lakshmana mastered the art of defence and, if necessary, attack. Rama perfected the hardest mantras that, once recited, allow you to ignore those gobby rogues, hunger, and her dry bow, thirst. Rama was fast becoming awesome. He could shoot an arrow exact through 90 palm trees to pierce a juicy apple, and could shift a hill or heave-ho an irksome cliff. But he had to master restraint, for the sage advised against causing a stink on nature's blossom harmony. When the boys were really skilled, it became a cinch, a doddle, sending back each astro weapon to its celestial shelf. The sage then loaded Rama with weapons for the journey. Trooping through the air out of nothing were brand new weapons of shiniest divine gold, paraded before Rama as if to say, "Lord, we are yours to command." Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Great. But I want to know how long you took to do the Ramayana and where the idea came from and what you were trying to do. Because there are lots of other translations, aren't there? But this is in your language.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a translation or two every year of this story in some part of the world. I think I just knew an oral version of it from growing up, and Diwali is... You know, I think it's now a kind of British festival as part of our British culture, and students... At primary schools now, you know, learn about Diwali every year. You know, they dress up as Ravana or Rama or Sita, and I've seen that in my daughter's school.
Yeah, my daughter too, actually. The first thing she did at her primary school was not, you know, the nativity play. It was Rama and Sita.
Yeah, it's just quite normal now, isn't it? Yeah. So it's time we claim this as our story.
Yeah.
And the more research I did on it, I got excited because it exists in many forms, I said earlier. One of the other things that excited me about it was that if I wanted, I could have done a very kind of a Greek version of it almost, because there's so many stories in the Ramayana that overlap or imitate things that happen in the Greek classics. But in the end, I thought I'd just go for the best version I could best fit. And when I was reading some academics, they reckon it's probably just merchants travelling at some point in the past, exchanging oral stories, and there was this global community where people are picking up ideas for each other for stories. And that's probably more likely the case with that story. So it felt to me it was an Indian story, an Asian story, but also probably a Western story, because there's so many overlaps.
Yeah, because one of the themes of this particular event is we're all from somewhere else, and that comes from a poem of mine, which I'll read later. But I was thinking about the overlapping. When did your family come over?
So my parents came over. My dad came over late 50s, 1950s, and... lived in a house...
From
Punjab, near the Golden Temple, and lived in a three-bed semi with about 10, 15 men, like you did in those days, for about a year, where, you know, so if you're doing a night shift, you sleep during the day, and you just share the rooms and sleep on floors. But, you know, back in those days, houses were cheap, weren't they? So I think he saved up within a year and bought a house, within the year, and then he called my mum over. So he'd been married in India then. She came over a couple of years after, I think. So that kind of migration is really different, isn't it? Yeah. But you've written loads about migration as well. Tell us about your migration. What's your fascination with India as well?
Okay, all right.
Because you've written a non-fiction book, which I've actually read, my wife's read, and we think it's fantastic. Your Tigers in Red.
Well, that's where one of the...
And you've written a
novel. We've done a lot of stuff together. And one of the things, your Tipu Safan, there's a lot of my Tiger book about Tipu. Who identified with the tiger, and he was one of the Muslim rulers in the south of India, and he fought the British. Because he was Muslim, now with the Hindu nationalists, they are downgrading Tipu, afraid they are.
As we speak. Yeah.
But he identified with the tiger and he commissioned this thing, which is the subject of the title poem in that, which is a great big wooden tiger. You've probably seen it in the V&A, eating a British soldier, and you roll up the key and you have the tiger roaring and lashing his tail, and the wooden soldier's arm goes up like that as his throat is eaten.
And he roars, doesn't he? Because it's two simultaneous sounds at the same time.
I think it may have stopped working. I think the sound may have stopped working now.
Yeah.
The first time I went to India was for my brother's wedding, because my brother's married to an Indian from Orissa. Maybe you didn't know that.
No, I didn't know.
Okay, so he was he's an anthropologist. He's written a book about human sacrifice in Orissa. He's written a book about bauxite mining and the whole sort of aluminium cartel. So he is rather marked out by the Modi government now as a troublemaker. But his wife is from a village girl from Mountain Orissa. So that was the first time I went. And then I went for tigers and conservation all around. Then I wrote a novel, which is set in India, about these fantastic frontline zoologists who live in the wild and combat not the animals, but the forces of destruction and vested interests, the mining and the logging and the politicians and so on, and the poachers, the terrible poachers. So those are those things. And because of those, working in those books and being around, I now have a lot of friends, I think, live in India.
Great. Shall I read? We should hear you now.
Okay. Yeah. This reading is sponsored by Sitara, the Indian restaurant. I'm really sorry they can't be here, but this is for them. This is a poem dedicated to a wonderful man who was from Gujarat. He's a doctor. He was a doctor all his life, but he was also a poet and a painter. And one of his paintings is very, very eloquent. It's for all the economic migrants in Mumbai. They're making roads and so on, and they're illiterate. And so they queue up for a letter writer under the shadow of the motorway to get their letters back home written. And this book is about migration. But, of course, the other face of the word migration and the concept is home, because you're leaving a home and you're trying to make another home. And so I did discover that all the poems in this turn out, you know, to have usually at the end of the poem the word home in it. And Gibbs painting the letter home, I just couldn't not write about it. So I wrote this in Mumbai during the monsoon, actually in his studio. And it's for Sitara, to thank them. The letter home. You painted the Saturday queue for a letter writer, cross-legged on a shore, in shadow of the unfinished flyover. I have health, over and over again. I am sending the money home. But what is home? Where you began, where a sister with a husband whose salary is regular, but he resents you anyway, this indigent who sees more of the world than he, has turned your family against you while you are gone? Or where the journeys take you, where work is, where you sleep behind plastic tacked to Uranus breeze block and cook at the edge of a 5-lane you are helping to build, watched by ashy-necked crows who make their nests out of sanitary towels from mounds of trash to the east. We are breaking stone for the motorway. I will come home when work is done. Under the luminous fuzz that does for stars in this city, you look into the well, wondering where it went wrong, what you could have done better. Look up. The hurt sky is bandaged in cloud. Earth has reversed her magnetic field, and the Mumbai monsoon, blown sideways like glycerine skirts, has calmed the grit that gets everywhere into wet silk paintable gleams, reminding us where it has come from, this element we all desire and have to struggle with. Home, the round white pebble with a blue-cut heart, whole geological dowries of copper, hooded turquoise, amethyst. Well, before I start my reading, I'm going to do something for the wonderful enterprise that the Poetry Festival is doing with Penn for Writers in Peril. And the writer I'm going to read from is called Liu Chia. I don't know if anyone knows Chinese here, but it's XIA. She's a poet and an artist, and she was a founding member of the Independent Chinese Pen Center. And she's married to another poet, an imprisoned poet, and critic and former independent Chinese Pen Center president, Liu Xiaobo. And she has been under extra legal house arrest since he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010. When they announced, the Nobel Committee announced that he'd won the Peace Prize, reporters descended on Liu Qia's apartment complex in Beijing. And she said she was planning to give a press conference, and police moved incredibly quickly to set up a roadblock at the entrance of that complex. But she did give a few phone interviews. And in some of these, she warned that an official promised to bring her to her husband in prison so that she could tell him of the award had an ulterior motive. They want to distance me from the media. And she told Reuters that just before her phone went dead. So after that, in these years, she she's been visited once by the media. Two reporters smuggled her in. She can't speak to anybody. She's been in hospital. She and her husband are not allowed to read the letters they write each other. That's the last 6 years. She is allowed to visit him once a month. But she doesn't want a doctor to come and see her because she's afraid they're going to sort of cart her off to a mental hospital, which is one of the things they do. So I'm going to read one poem of hers. You know, whatever has happened to our country in the last, all the breakages and damage and fear of the last 12 days, it's nothing to what poets face and speak to in other countries, and I'm afraid China is one of them. This is called The Black Sail, and it's one of her poems. The red-faced man goes fishing and catches your favourite fish, a black fish, a fish who knows your thoughts. Your heart splits in pain and your teeth clench. Dejected, you stroke the sea, and where your hand touches, fish jump up, so many fish. So many fish seduce the red-faced man to hoist the sail and set out to sea for the night, forgetting it's dark. One may get lost. You reach out your arms and pull the red-faced man close, his hair floating like green seaweed. Then you calm down and light a cigarette. Green smoke rises. The next day, when firecrackers clear the way for the full black sail, you become a gust of wind, a cloud, an eye. The woman who loses the man loses her breast milk overnight. You appear in the dreams of that thirsty child often, telling him his father is happy in the sea. And he is happy. The child becomes a man, keeping silent all day long. He remembers everything but says nothing. The woman's tide ebbs in the distance and the green seaweed moves with each wave. It's hard to think to read anything after that, but I'm going to carry on now. My own reading, but in her honour, really. This book is about migration. I'm going to read from it mainly, not the other one, because this idea of immigration, which is tearing Europe apart, and of course tearing many other countries apart too. Migration is how the world began, not just how civilization began, because we all came out of Africa originally, but how life came to this earth. The first cell, however it got here, neither Dawkins nor Hawkins knows the answer to how life began on this planet, but it might have come from outer space with a meteor, it might have come from out of the sea, but whatever it did, the first cell, and the closest thing to the first cell in our world now is blue-green algae, little green splodges like that. The first cell, wherever it came from, the first thing it did was to spread. And that is the raw basis of migration. You come there, and then another thing, and then another thing. So there's as it were, good and bad in that, because, you know, cancer cells do it too, but people do it too, and, you know, wildflowers do it too. Orchids spread like that. And that is the basic movement of migration. So here's to the first cell. Born in a deep sea vent, synthesized by lightning in a reducing atmosphere, or carried here by meteorite, we're all from somewhere else. Algae, first self-replicating molecule on Earth, pulls carbon from organic substrate, performs the world's first magic photosynthesis of air to oxygen, and creates copies of herself, uncountable as starlings flocking, or the pure gold bricks Sheba sent to Solomon by mule. Cell, in the air, on the rocks. Song, hoping to be heard in a heart cut open. Little blue-green, dreaming of pattern and form. Tiny horseman of apocalypse. So the next thing after that is other sorts of vegetables and fruit. And there's a wonderful book by a man called Barry Juniper about the history of the apple. And I couldn't not read, in Herefordshire, I couldn't not read this poem, especially with a cider supper tonight. So this is for Barry Juniper, who I did once have the pleasure of meeting. And he actually pruned an apple tree for me. But he's got this, there's a story, that's right, it's called The Story of the Apple, and it's really fascinating. Fly me beyond Taklamakan Desert and the blossom trees of immortality to heaven's mountain Tian Shan, heaving itself into air above the snow line. Melt pours down, floods carve an underworld of caves, and in move the bears, whose lazy sorcery turns hawthorn bullets into quince and apple. Because everyone, given time, changes everyone else. It's a world on fire, and the horse falls in love. The wild, red, long-maned horse of the Lascaux Cave, whose teeth and gut help this pip on its adventure. Hooves drive the apple core deep in the soil of the steppe and the Turkic corridor. Horse dung and dung beetles spread invisible orchards, wouldn't you know, hidden in the heart of apple. To William Tell, protesting an unjust edict. Newton, dozing in a Cambridge garden. To Eden and to Eve. So apples sprang wherever we tamed the horse. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a poem in here I'm not going to read because I spent 3 years researching birds. What I wanted to do in this book was to head, of course, for human migration and what is happening now. This came out in 2012, but there were already dreadful tragedies hitting the news. But I wanted the birds to do the work, the dangerous journey. So I researched bird for 3 years, and there's the storm petrel. There's a poem here about it, which I'm not going to read, but its name, they are called the Children of Storm. And so this name reappears as the migrants later in the book. But I'm going to read a poem about the bar-headed goose, because all different birds all have their own different forms of migration. But the bar-headed goose is one of the most extraordinary. Okay, so they're normal sort of size, goose size. The thing about geese is that they have to, large birds, you probably all know about this, but I had to learn it. Large birds can't migrate night and day in the air like the smaller birds do. Smaller birds can fuel themselves, store up the fat, and just go. For some of them, for eight, you know, I think the red-winged godwit does it 8 days, night and day, non-stop, no stop at all. But a goose can't do that because it can't put on any more fat because it's too heavy then for its wings to carry it. So they have to stop and they have to do their big flights in one go. The bar-headed goose, it's got these very handsome black bars on it, and in the 19th century it was much sort of sought after and still is today as a sort of ornamental bird in European gardens. But they nest in sort of Central Asia, and then they winter in Assam and the lowlands around Bangladesh and Pakistan. But they have to fly over this obstacle, which is, of course, the Himalayas. So how do they do that? Because a bird flying uses up much more oxygen than a bird just pecking around on the ground. And up there, the oxygen is a quarter what it is down here. So how do they do that? They evolved a sort of hemoglobin that is much, much more instantly absorbent of oxygen. And their capillaries went much, much deeper into all the different cells of their body so that the oxygen will penetrate. Such oxygen as available will penetrate to them much quicker than any other bird. How did they get like that? That, you know, in Eden, the goose, they weren't like that. They evolved like that because they were flying that route before Himalayas rose. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. It doesn't argue for intelligence. You know, a fox would see these things and think, all right, I'll go another way. But the birds are programmed. They're all instinct. They're little functioning of the brain, but a lot of instinct. Their breathing apparatus, for instance, is much, much larger than their brain, much, much larger in proportion than ours is, because they have to do all this. So if you Google a bar-headed goose, you can see them flying over the Himalayas. It's terrifying. So this is how they do it. And, of course, this shows you, because this was before the Himalayas rose, before those other continents bumped into each other and everything. That bird migration records the movement of Earth's crust, overheard at breakfast in the guest house. 3 millennia of mapping, furrows on moonlight, and never mind plate tectonics, how mountains rose in a crash of the lithosphere. Let continents do their worst. They split, they clash. But the bird's flight path is what it always was. Every heartbeat, every contracting muscle is a chronicle. Bar-headed geese wait for the perfect wind. All heads turn, each bill in parallel, rouge compass to a crystal, towards the cloud-headed peak. They take off in a rush. First buffet, and a young one falters, drops. The mother checks, wing beats fail, then pick up. She can't spare, no, cut to the quick. She can't spare a second, tossed back up on a slant by gins of the mountain. Hurricane gales force them down to rock and ice. They sleep till dawn breaks gold lattice through black shadow cloud. One lifts a head out of snow, and then another to wind howl and glare. They stare at the glacier. Yes, they call, yes, to try again. Oxygen speeds like cocaine through capillaries in deep muscle, and here they come over Everest, gliding down as if cannon fire ice, the dive disappear of a chick she nearly gave her life for back in Kyrgyzstan, and the entire flocks fall into avalanche were all an absurd nightmare from which she woke. So all these bird poems, and it is quite extraordinary if you look at videos of birds that have come through unbelievable stuff. They land, and then they look like any other bird. They start pecking around, and it's what happens afterwards. It's the dangerous journey, and then afterwards, and of course that's what happens with human beings too. Right. So this is now moving. What I hoped is that when I've given the animals, and there's not just birds, it's other animals too, their dangerous journeys and their suffering, I thought then I could just put the people there. So this is, 10. This is called Ghost Ship. I know there are so many dreadful drownings, and this, you know, this was before all the crossings from Turkey that we've seen. But there was this story. ghost ship. You have to get out. But this is how you imagine you might go when you wake at night, afraid of moving on from Gambia or Guinea-Bissau, and hear the red slick in your temple beat like waves around the ghost ship discovered off Ragged Point, Barbados. A 6-foot yacht adrift, no name, no flag, and a phantom crew. 11 young men in green, red, orange, blue, mummified in salt of their own sweat. You can't shake out of your head that airline ticket from Senegal, the note in a dead boy's pocket. Excuse me, this is the end. Sorry to my family in Basada. Saying how the skipper disappeared before they left Cape Verde. How he could have jumped like his friend when they were towed, and how one night the rope was slashed by a machete. Well, this is a bit of a grim bit, I'm afraid. This is about Sangat before it was closed, and of course it's the jungle in Paris now, and God knows what the status of that is going to be. Sangat, you can hear two possible meanings of the name in the poem. The place without a door. Listen. There are dragons under cities, monsters in white spaces on sea maps. Sangat is a commune on the coast of France, facing water which the English call English Channel, a border for which many men, and women too, have died. The name means gap in sand. When we were there, we knew it was the place without a door. Mark the spot in my brother's heart, where he built a cardboard shrine for our wasteland jungle. Check the wall where someone graphed, "Nous voulons de l'air pour nos enfants." The cement octagons where we hid at night to rush the axle of Spanish lorries. The bridge where my brother jumped that train into the tunnel. Well, the birds can peck around on the ground when they've migrated, though of course they have to compete for territory with other feeding territory with other birds. But what happens to a lot of migrants here, of course, is a detention centre. A prayer labyrinth is a lot of sort of 11th, 12th century cathedrals in France, I think in Spain as well, had one of these sort of carved into the ground, and you went along it with your rosary and you followed this until the end and the centre you found enlightenment. The prayer labyrinth. She went looking for her daughter. How many visit Hades and live? Your only hope is the long labyrinth of visa application interviews with a volunteer from a charity you're not allowed to meet. You've been caught by a knock on the door at dawn, or hiding in a truck of toilet tissue, or just getting stuck in a turnstile. You're on Dead Island, a detention centre. The Russian refugees who leapt from the 15th floor of a Glasgow tower block to the Red Road spring burn. Sergei, Tatiana and their son, who, when immigration officers were at the door, tied themselves together before they jumped, knew what was coming. Anyway, you're here. Evidence of cigarette burns all over your body has been dismissed by the latest technology. You're dragged from your room, denied medication or a voice. You can't see your children. They're behind bars somewhere else. You go on hunger strike. You're locked in a corridor 3 days without water, then handcuffed through the biopsy on your right breast. You've no choice but to pray and to walk the never-ending path of meditation on not yet. Your nightmare was homegrown. You're seeking sanctuary. They say you don't belong. They give you a broken finger, a punctured lung. Oh, sorry about this. I'll read you one more poem from this. It's a tiny poem, and it's about the denial of asylum. One of the things, my daughter worked in human rights for quite a long time, and she worked at the
the Helen Bamber Centre, and they had to screen people, help people decide who to help of the asylum seekers. And one unfair thing that happens is that when they come here, they've been raped, tortured, God knows what, in their own country, and they're traumatised, and they're instantly interviewed, and they're asked questions. And then 3 years later, perhaps, they may actually have their application heard. And if they answer anything in the slightest bit different from what they said at that traumatised interview, they have this stamp saying LOC, lack of credibility, and they're denied it. Purple ink. She has waited 3 years for this, too ashamed to even half tell the young woman in spectacles tapping a purple barrow on a desk exactly what the soldiers did to her, each versatile in his turn. She gets wrong, date your mother was born, and sees a stamp, the colour of desert night, descend on her file. I'm sorry those are so grim. I'm going to read now from a couple of poems from this book. This is about conflict too, but it's also about music. The oud is the origin of the guitar. It's the Arabian lute. El oud became lute when the crusaders, other migrators and colonists, there are so many different forms of migration, when they saw the oud and they brought it back to Europe as the lute. I'm going to read. It's set in the Middle East, but music is the image of harmony. Of you do music and it brings people together. But this is from the crucifixion sequence, and it's from Mary's point of view. There he is up there. It's from the Seven Last Words. Relationship. That time he was sleepy as the moon, and she carried him 3 hours to the priest. The chip of kingfisher lapis she tied round his wrist to turn away the evil eye. Where did that go? He was shy in the playground, afraid of heights, of fire at night. Yesterday's glisten like photos melting together in the rain. Prints of small feet in wet sand. His first step without holding her hand. Keeping him quiet in siesta. Mending clothes through those long mother afternoons you think will never end. The first glint of a tooth. First pair of shoes. Whose days were those? Blink and they're gone. Is he most her son? Not back then, but now, when he disowns her and gives her to his friend. She used to listen as if everything he said was truth would turn to gold, but these words come to her like rubble at ends of the earth. Does he think he's looking after her? She's been dismissed. He's done, it seems, with relationship, like a lover breaking a bond, as if bond did not exist. Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother. I'm going to read something slightly more cheerful now. There's a wonderful Japanese art, and Ledbury, I love coming to reading at Ledbury, and you can always trust the audiences. But also, they make wonderful pottery, and I've got several bowls. Bowls saying Ledbury Festival, you know, 2000 and whatever. And there's an art in Japanese pottery called kintsugi, and if a pot breaks, you can put it together, and you've got the recipe of it in the poem how you put it together. And then the pot is worth more because the putting together is random and beautiful. And, you know, Japanese, you know, aesthetics, they worship the found, the given. I love that. I've actually changed it to Chinese pottery, which I know slightly more about because my grandfather used to collect it. But it's really about brokenness. And I think we're all feeling, you know, we're all reeling from a sense of brokenness in this country at the moment. But it's about putting things together. You know, there's an awful self-help book which I've seen in Watersons called Stronger at the Broken Places. yes, I can see I'm making a face. But I suppose there is something in that if a Japanese potter can mend a pot like this. Look that up on Google. They look like flashes of lightning. They're amazing. On the art of kintsugi. Just as the Chinese master in kilns of Longquan dropped a Qingbai bowl that took years to make, trying for the perfect luster, shadow green patina, faint turquoise wash over wafer-thin kaolin, with an uneven rose glow at the ledge inviting the onlooker to contemplate. Just as he picked shards off the stone floor and soldered the crazed, apparently irrevocable, breaks with zigzags of lacquer, resin, and powdered gold. And then, what do you know, it was valued in the markets of Jingzhen beyond the price of Buddha's hand citron or emperor's glaze, worth more, so much more, for the brokenness. But no, wait, it's not what you're thinking, that I smashed what I had, true featherware translucence, for the sake of upping the price or even the wonder. It was accident. Slippage through fingers that wrecked my once-in-a-blue-moon celadon. But after the shock came the joy of finding and then bringing back to the world. This is porcelain we're talking of here, not a life. What was, or what could have been, lost. I forgot to tell you that it's only worth more in those markets if you did it by accident. You mustn't smash it on purpose. do you think I've got... is it okay if I read one more poem? Because this is my new book, which I'm very nervous about, and I've just stuck... It's not really blue. I stuck the new cover on some blue card, and I taped it all together because I wanted to see what it sounded like. And this is the first poem in it. It's a sort of long sequence. I suppose rather like what you've done with the Ramayana.
Yeah.
Because what you did is he took a whole long epic and then you sort of chopped it up, didn't you?
Yeah, that's more or less it. Yeah. Into loads of chapters and sections, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a wonderful idea because then it's sort of, I think...
The Christmas poem?
This is the Christmas poem, yeah.
The whole thing is?
The whole thing is one long Christmas poem, but I have chopped it up like you have into three nights. So it's Christmas Eve, Christmas night, and Christmas Day. But, of course, you know, I was thinking of refugees. I was thinking of homelessness, really. So this is, and it's spoken by the Angel of Silence. And this is its first outing, and I wanted to do it here because you're a poetry audience, you're a real poetry audience. Mm. Anyway, so I don't know how it's going to go or how I'm going to feel about it, but here we go. So this is the beginning, and it's set in old St. Pancras Old Church just above King's Cross. The voice of silence. I am the oldest angel, the dark side of the brain. Everything untold, suppressed, unseemly, or wild is under my protection. I am Charum, angel of silence. I'm the seed of fire in a hearth you thought was cold, the stillness when you step into moonlit snow. And who you are in private. I appear whenever you drop into quiet, when surface cracks, luster and veneer rub thin. Silence, you say, when you make room for wonder. I am less and less here, but tonight, for 24 strange hours in the darkness of the year, I have a voice. For this is Christmas Eve, when everything hidden comes alive. Children's toys that have rolled under a sofa or stayed in the cupboard unplayed with for years. The mice you weren't aware of in the wall. And your own unspoken longing to be given something more by life. Suddenly, if you listen, all unnoticed things can talk. And so can I. Tonight I play a part in everyone's secret search for something better. Come with me, to St. Pancras Old Church on a little London hill ruined with 20 centuries of human stories. Nearby, shops are closing on Camden High Street, Euston Road. The sky is that bruise colour you hardly think is sky, and sodium lights from the station terminal flicker in glass sides of the bus shelter like a zodiac on mica. London's neon glory falls on wet purple tarmac of Royal College Street and its last-minute traffic, on roadworks, traffic cones, surveillance cameras above the door of a homeless hostel, and the final Eurostar before the Christmas break. Below us, evening pads down Pancras Road and pokes its nose through shy, half-open doors of girls tying last-minute mistletoe in Goldington Crescent, Unity Mews, Penryn, while young men, fresh from the gym, zip back the first ring pull of lager. Up here, the evening glides over golden moss on the flat-top tomb of Mary Wollstonecraft, where her daughter, whom she never knew and died giving birth to, used to meet her lover, Shelley, in secret. And here is the Hardy Tree, where a young surveyor, not yet a writer, ordered to clear consecrated land to make the new thing, railway, fanned, dug up gravestones like slices of grey bread around a sapling ash in a memorial wheel. Now the roots look, flow and tentacle through crumbled names on lichened marble. People are trickling through the gates, up the path, around the monuments and into church, a stream of fur-trimmed anoraks and trailing scarves for the children's service. These two figures, hurrying because they're late, are Sue and her daughter, Holly. Holly is 7. She's a pony, prancing on the firefly shimmer of LED Lightbringer trainers through a 1,000-year-old arch into an ancient shrine built over a Roman altar on the bank of the River Fleet. Long covered over, like the secret hopes hidden in every soul, which might flare out tonight in joy or disappointment, in a loneliness hardest to accept this time of year, or else might bear new fruit. That's why I'm here. I belong with secrets kindly kept, with possibilities, with mute. For what might a mysterious birth, witnessed by distant shepherds and foreign kings, the longings conjured up by giving, gift and given, and this time-stopping rift in every schedule? Yes, what can Christmas do to all of us? Thank you.